It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress. We'll talk about how the legislature is changing as more women and minorities join its ranks.
But first, while the world's attention has been riveted on Ebola in recent months, a new report out today from the World Health Organization says there's another infectious disease that should be on our radar, tuberculosis, and the global burden of TB is higher than previously estimated.
The WHO says the new numbers can be attributed in part to better data collection. They estimate that 9 million people developed TB in 2013, 1.5 million died from it.
Mandy Slutsker joins us to help put these numbers in perspective. She's Senior Associate for Tuberculosis at ACTION, a global health advocacy partnership. Mandy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
The World Health Organization says the number of estimated cases of TB has increased because of change to their data collection methods. Can you talk about where the difference comes from and how these numbers may be more accurate?
Yes. So it's not that there's more of TB than before. It's just more that we know about now. Previously, all of the data had been collected by countries that report to the World Health Organization the number of people who get TB in their country. And this year, with support from the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, as well as USAID, there's been funding for new surveys called prevalence surveys in countries which use a more rigorous analytical method to try and track new cases of TB. And they've discovered that we've been wrong the entire time.
Now, TB isn't a disease that is on many people's radars, at least in the United States, and hasn't gotten the headlines that Ebola has gotten. Why is it significant that 9 million people estimated to have it worldwide?
It's significant because it is an infectious disease that spreads through the air when infected people cough or sneeze. And each person who's infected with TB usually goes on to infect an average of 10 to 15 people each year. And because we're all connected by the air that we breathe, TB anywhere is TB everywhere. And it doesn't matter where it is. It doesn't respect borders, and it affects people in the United States and around the world.
How would you compare tuberculosis to other infectious diseases around the world in terms of severity and mortality rate?
TB is among the most severe, and it kills 1.5 million people each year. The thing that's different about it is that it is preventable and it is treatable, and it's atrocious that we allow 1.5 million people to die each year from a preventable and treatable illness. Another thing about TB is that it's been consistently underfunded and underprioritized, which is why the disease keeps outpacing our attempts to control it. In the report that you mentioned, the World Health Organization reports that there's a $2 billion gap to fight the disease. And it's time that our government and the governments of the world come together to invest more in fighting tuberculosis.
How do you treat and prevent tuberculosis?
So you prevent tuberculosis in the same way that you would prevent the flu, in that it spreads through the air, so it's important that infected people, you know, cover their mouths and get on treatment. You treat it using a combination of different antibiotics that are taken for about 6 to 12 months. And if you're anyone like me, you can imagine I have trouble remembering to take a daily multivitamin. So taking an antibiotic, let alone multiple antibiotics, every single day for 6 to 12 months is quite difficult. And one of the reasons why the disease is so bad is because it is difficult to treat, and it's causing a lot more problems than if it was just like strep throat, where you could take a simple course of antibiotics.
Why isn't TB getting the funding that it needs globally to fight it?
I think it's because TB is a disease of poverty. It has been historically, even though anyone can get it. And because it's a disease of poverty, it makes it easy to ignore. It doesn't affect most of us, so we don't think about it. But really, it is a disease that is a major problem in the world, and it's unusual in that it can live in your body without giving you any symptoms. And a third of the world, that's about 2 billion people, are walking around right now with tuberculosis bacteria in their body. And each year they have a 10% chance of getting sick with active disease. So it's really important that we take action now.
If someone has a case of TB that's gone untreated, what are the symptoms?
It's usually coughing, night sweats, unexplained weight loss, and fever.
And that can progress to lung failure, I suppose.
Yes, but TB can also, because it's a bacteria, it can infect anywhere in the body. So it could go to your knee, it could go to your spine, but it most often attacks in the lungs.
Now, it's been reported that TB is the second highest, we have the second highest rate of it after HIV. Are the two linked at all? Do we see higher cases of TB where we see cases of HIV that are also high?
Very much so. So TB is actually the leading killer of people living with HIV/AIDS. And 80% of the cases of TB and HIV occur in sub-Saharan Africa. And we're seeing an emergence of tuberculosis in areas that have been most heavily affected by HIV/AIDS.
Now, one of the cases that we've seen from the Ebola outbreak in Africa has been that when there is an infectious disease outbreak anywhere in the world, that the rest of the world needs to sit up and take notice a lot sooner and to be invested in the containment and treatment of that disease. Is that same case just as applicable for TB as it is for Ebola?
Yes, it's just as applicable for TB. With public health, you get what you pay for. And if you don't invest in proper health systems, and if you don't invest in tuberculosis programs and the new tools that are needed to diagnose and treat the disease, then you're going to continue to have outbreaks around the world, and it's going to remain to be a huge killer, even though it is preventable and treatable, unlike Ebola, which is, at the moment, there is no treatment.
Now, the CDC has reported that the number of TB cases in the United States is at an all-time low of 3 cases per 100,000 people. Who's most likely to be affected by tuberculosis here in the United States?
It really could be anyone. I think over half the cases occur in 4 states, New York, Florida, California, and Texas. So if you live in those states, I think you'd be more likely to get it. But it really, because it lives in your body for so long before you usually get sick, it's hard to tell when you might have picked it up. People who travel tend to be a bit more at risk.
What is the most effective tool that we have in the fight to eradicate TB in the future?
One thing I find very exciting is a new tool to diagnose TB called GeneXpert that is able to diagnose TB in under 2 hours, and it can detect if the disease is resistant to some of the antibiotics used to treat it. And that has been rolled out extensively in South Africa, and as a result, more people are actually getting diagnosed with TB. Now, the problem is we're unable to keep up with the amount of people that are diagnosed and treat them. And the World Health Organization reported in this report today that there are 39,000 people around the world that are on waiting lists for drug-resistant tuberculosis medication.
How would you like to see citizenry, people, governments, health officials reacting to this report from the World Health Organization?
I think people need to react by investing in tuberculosis programming worldwide, not just here, but around the world. Also investing in research and development for new tools. But there are things that average citizens can do to get involved. The organization I work with, Results, is a citizens' grassroots advocacy organization working to empower individuals to exercise their personal and political power for change. And we have chapters throughout Wisconsin, I know in Madison and Milwaukee, as well as many other cities in the United States. And we teach citizens how to become involved in politics and how to engage their elected officials, whether it be on tuberculosis or other diseases of poverty. And so I encourage the listeners to visit results.org and learn how they can get involved.
Mandy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Mandy Slutsker, Senior Associate for Tuberculosis at ACTION, a global health advocacy partnership.
It's time for a weekly look at the inner workings of Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
Congress continues to look at the country's response to Ebola, weighing increased funding and how to enact border screenings. We're also 13 days away from midterm elections. Most polls continue to show a Republican takeover of the Senate as likely.
And we'll take a look at diversity in the legislature. This week, Elizabeth Warren spoke up about sexism in the Senate. And when a new crowd moves into Washington after midterm elections, more Latino representatives are expected in their ranks.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. He's USA Today's politics editor. And Paul, it's good to have you back.
Nice to be on. Thanks a lot for having me.
So here we are, 2 weeks away from the midterms. Any seismic shifts or maybe minuscule shifts that we should be aware of as we head in?
Cannot come soon enough for me at this point. I don't know, seismic shifts. I mean, I think the number of races are beginning to show some form that may be interesting. I mean, we have a new poll out today that we've done in the Colorado Senate race, and it really does show a trend towards the Republican challenger, Cory Gardner. The Democratic incumbent, Mark Udall, has been struggling in that race. And all the polls, ours goes a little further. Ours suggests it's a 6 or 7 point lead for Gardner, but all of the polls have been 3, 4, 5% lead for Gardner over the past several weeks. That begins to make you believe that that lead is baking in, and that we just changed our forecast for that race to leans Republican from pure toss-up. So that might be one in the GOP camp at this point.
And how big a deal is that when a race significantly starts to lean toward one direction?
Well, it's a big deal in the sense that this is a race that a year ago Democrats were not at all concerned about. They had a solid incumbent who was well-liked, and they did not expect this to be a battleground state. When Congressman Cory Gardner decided to leave the House of Representatives and run for the Senate, suddenly they had a good candidate for the Republicans, and it put that race on the map. So now it's gone from being a race that nobody considered really competitive to one that we now believe the Republicans are in the lead, essentially. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that he's going to win, right? But it certainly means that it's going to take more money for the Democrats to defend if they think they've got a chance. They're going to have to spend for it now a lot more than they would have what we thought they were going to do a year ago.
Senator Elizabeth Warren was in Colorado not long ago stumping for Udall. And when the heavy hitters come in like that, we've got Bill Clinton, for instance, who'll be heading to Wisconsin in the coming days. How big a deal is that? How significant is that in maybe moving the needle for a candidate?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, there's no doubt that it is most valuable for get-out-the-vote efforts, particularly in places with early voting. Right. I mean, the Congressional Black Caucus has been down in Louisiana, and they're going to several other states over the past week because early voting has begun there. So if you can get people fired up in a rally and then basically shoot them out the door to the ballot box a couple hours later, that's very helpful. It is a real good get-out-the-vote technique. I don't know that, you know, having an endorsement from Elizabeth Warren helps you sway an undecided voter. Right. I mean, it's like anything else. It's sort of hard to know. I will say that in that Colorado race, there was an endorsement from a newspaper that was considered a big deal because, again, it was an endorsement for Gardner, a newspaper that had previously endorsed Udall. It sort of showed the erosion of Udall's support. I don't know that these big sort of, forgive the word, celebrity endorsements matter in that sense of swaying public opinion, but they definitely help sort of galvanize your base and get people to the polls.
On another note, the White House began talks with Congress this week about increasing funding to respond to Ebola. What is the White House looking for from Congress?
We don't know yet. At the moment, they have said that they are well enough supplied, but that they have about $1 billion to play with, and they've spent down, you know, not half of that yet. But it's going to be very clear that starting in December, when the new spending bill is required, that we're going to need to reassess priorities, and they are in negotiations with the House and the Senate appropriators over what would be available and what they're going to do. I mean, by and large, lawmakers in both parties, Republicans and Democrats, have said whatever we need to fight this, we will fight, and we will spend to fight Ebola. I just honestly don't know that they yet have a number or they yet know what the priority is. I think part of that's going to depend on seeing how the spread is, or if there is a spread at all in the United States.
Now, judging by media coverage and seeming levels of anxiety, it seems as though last week or maybe the week before was sort of the peak of anxiety about Ebola.
Peak
now,
panic.
Based on that, are we still seeing calls to close borders to West African countries?
Yeah. There are still members of Congress who are saying we should close borders to West African countries. We should establish travel bans for anybody flying. And keep in mind that we're not really closing the borders. What we're doing is saying that we will not issue any new visas to countries where, particularly the three countries where there is a real outbreak of Ebola. I believe it's Liberia and Sierra Leone and the third one I'm blanking on at the moment.
Guinea.
Guinea, that's right. The issue there is instead what the administration is doing is beginning to funnel all passengers from those countries through airports, you know, specific airports that have protocols in place. I think there's five airports where you basically, if you're going to be flying to the U.S. from one of those countries, you'd have to come through, aside from passing through various screenings, you'd also have to come through those designated airports. So the administration is taking these calls seriously and is attempting to implement something that they think will calm the fears, but they really don't want to do a full-out visa ban from those countries. But I suspect that there's going to be another hearing on Friday in the House of Representatives. I suspect you'll hear more conversation about that topic then.
Now, is the White House taking hits on this one, or any party in particular?
Well, you know, the White House takes hits because, of course, the White House is in charge. You know, I mean, by definition, whenever things go bad, people start to worry about the competence of the administration. You usually rely on government to solve problems for you, and sometimes they don't. I think certainly when there was a concern about nurses who had been treating an Ebola patient getting on airplanes, flying to Cleveland, and hanging out in a bridal registry shop for 3 hours, you wonder how the heck that's possible. That stuff rebounds really badly on the administration. Now, keep in mind, Obama then canceled a bunch of travel, a bunch of his own travel, stayed in Washington, and has sort of made every effort to say, I am engaged, I'm engaged, I'm engaged. He's meeting today with the new Ebola czar he's appointed, a guy named Ron Klain. The whole idea is to try and establish competence and management to try and sort of back down the public panic. Maybe that helps, maybe it doesn't. I will say, for what it's worth, that there is, you know, I think, tragically, Americans still have relatively short attention spans, and so, you know, a shooting in Canada today is going to be the head of the news. And may bump Ebola off the front pages for a day or two, and then maybe that starts to tamp down some of the fear.
Now, moving on to Senator Elizabeth Warren, she's had some interesting things today, some interesting things to say about sexism in Congress. She said she's experienced it. She cited other women who've experienced sexist remarks in Congress. How has Congress evolved as more women join its ranks?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of sensitivity to this issue, or more sensitivity to these kinds of issues, you know, over the past decades. You know, I mean, remember 1992, I believe, was the year of the woman. Suddenly we had, you know, a half dozen woman senators we hadn't had before. Now that number is up to, gosh, I believe we're in the 15, 16, 17 women senators, maybe up to 20 by next year. You know, so women are becoming an integrated part of the organization, which, by all accounts, has been an old boys club for 200 years. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. But it was 25 years ago that Senator Bob Packwood was finally drummed out of office for a repeated grabbing of staff and, you know, coming on to women. That was sort of the first eye-opening story about gender discrimination and abuse in the Senate. And my suspicion is, like any other place where you're dealing with, honestly, a bunch of 70-year-old white men, you are frequently dealing with people who may have still some fairly sexist attitudes and behaviors. I think the Senate is interested, is concerned. I believe that there are a lot of people in the Senate who are aware and trying to do something about this. And by the way, I think there are a lot of members of the Senate, men in the Senate, who really do respect their female colleagues. But I also believe that, like any big organization, you're never going to be able to be done with those kind of behaviors entirely. There will always be a little bit of it.
And, Paul, as we wrap up, just real quickly, are we expecting a lot of new women in the Senate, in Congress?
Yeah, you're expecting several new women in the Senate. I know Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia is likely to be a new senator. There are a couple other, we expect another handful of Latino House members. There'll be a slightly larger Latino delegation, as it were, in the Congress next year. I believe we'll have two African-American senators elected at the same time for the first time in our history. So, you know, you're seeing diversity increase in the Congress as you see it increase around the country.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Veronica. Be well.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time for a behind-the-scenes look at the country's legislature.
Right now, we continue our series of candidate forums. Earlier this week, we heard from the candidates running for governor and for the 19th state Senate district seat. Now we turn to the statewide office of Secretary of State.
It's a position currently held by Democrat Doug LaFollette. We'll hear from him later on. And there are three challengers, all with different visions of the office's future, and some looking to reform it, some looking to eliminate it altogether.
We'll talk to all four candidates over the next hour. Joining us first is Julian Bradley. He's the Republican candidate for Secretary of State of Wisconsin. He joins us from our studios in La Crosse. Julian, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, to start, why are you running for Secretary of State?
I'm running for this office because something's got to be done with it. For 36 years, Doug LaFollette, my Democratic opponent and the incumbent, has been there. And since he's been in that office, duties and responsibilities have consistently been removed, one by one by one, to the point where people have called for a constitutional amendment to remove the office altogether. We know that we will have this office for the next 4 years. So the next person that's going to be in that office needs to have a plan, have a vision, and do something with it. You're going to hear somebody come on and say, well, I'm pledging to eliminate it. None of us can actually do that. You can make a pledge to do that, but you don't have the power to do that. That takes an act of the legislature. It actually takes two acts of the legislature. It needs to pass twice consecutively and then go to a referendum by the voters. So that's how you would eliminate the office. So I'm not focusing on that. I'm focusing on what the office can do for the next 4 years, and that's why I'm running for the office. We need to bring value back to it. Secretary LaFollette collects a taxpayer-funded paycheck, yet I don't feel that he's doing his best to earn that.
Well, what would you do that he has not done to bring meaning to that office and do something positive with it?
Well, it starts with rebuilding bridges of communication to the other branches of state government. I have a three-point plan. It's reform, restore, rebuild. But I'm going to start with rebuilding because that's the one thing that he just hasn't done. He's absolutely failed at that. In forums that I've had with him, two of them we've done, we've talked about the fact that in the last 4 years, so the last term since 2010, he's only reached out to the governor on one occasion and not reached out to the legislature at all. It's the legislature who decides what happens with the office as far as duties and responsibilities go. So you'd think that if he were serious about restoring those duties or responsibilities, he would have, you know, reached out to the people that could do it. And he's admittedly not done that. So we're going to start there. We're going to rebuild those bridges. We're going to open up the lines of dialogue and see what it is that we can do to earn a paycheck for the next 4 years while the decision on whether or not to eliminate is hashed out in the legislature.
Do you think, you're going to be working, I know, for these 4 years, but do you think the decision should be to eliminate the office when all is said and done?
Right now, I'm partial to reforming. I want to restore some of these duties back to the office. Like I said, I've got a four-year vision. I don't think elimination is a relevant topic for this office, especially for me, because I'm running for it, and I don't have a vote unless it becomes a referendum issue on our ballot in 4 years. I can tell you that our focus needs to be on ensuring that the taxpayers are getting their money's worth out of the Secretary of State.
So if you're elected and you reach out to the legislature or the governor's office, what kind of responsibilities, what kind of duties would you like to see restored to the office of Secretary of State?
I think it starts with getting corporations back. That's something that would keep us uniform with a lot of the other secretaries of state within the country. They have, when a new business is looking to do business within the state of Wisconsin, they usually call a Secretary of State, rather in other states they call a Secretary of State, and here in Wisconsin it goes somewhere else. I think bringing that back would be a great service for the state. And then notaries and some of the other things that really occur in most states, so there's a little less confusion when dealing with the Wisconsin Secretary of State.
In a lot of other states, the Secretary of State is the one in charge of elections as well. Do you think that should be the case here in Wisconsin?
I think if the office is going to be there long term, it's something worth evaluating. One thing that we all agree, many agree on is that the GAB is not working. It's not functioning as we'd like it to. One possible solution to that would be having the Secretary of State oversee elections. Now, a lot of people say, well, why would you put a partisan official over elections? Your county clerks here in the state of Wisconsin are all partisan elected. All 72 are. We trust them at the county level. I think it's good to have somebody that's accountable directly to the people, that can answer directly to the voters, that would oversee the elections. But again, that's still a long term. That's something to be looked at once we've decided, once we've looked at this office and said, okay, now that we have somebody that's competent there, now that we have somebody that's working on behalf of the taxpayers that's in that office, what else can we do with it? How can we optimize it?
Now, are there any new responsibilities you think could be a part of the Secretary of State job?
Just about anything coming back to the office would almost be new to the office, because my opponents lost so many of them. He even lost the Great Seal at one point, which is one of the few duties that remains, and it ended up being damaged, and it cost a little bit of money to fix. I think the focus for the next 4 years for this office, and with me as your Secretary of State, is going to be on bringing value to the office. You know, a lot of talk has been made about jobs. Obviously, we need more jobs here in the state of Wisconsin. Having another ambassador working with the legislature, with the governor, and on behalf of the state to try to bring in more business so we can get people back to work. And anything short of that, I just think is unnecessary right now. We need to focus on those things.
You know, when people go to the polls, Secretary of State is at most an afterthought, I think, a lot of the time. How can you convey the value you're hoping to create in this job to the voter? How can you say, here's what it's in it for you if I'm elected as Secretary of State?
Well, that's what my campaign's been all about. I launched in January 18th, and since then I've traveled over 53,000 miles crisscrossing our state, so that I can meet as many people as possible. And frankly, many people didn't know we even elected a Secretary of State, let alone who they are, who it is, rather. And again, that goes back to a failure of the incumbent. Anybody that can be there, first elected in 1974, and people don't know who you are, that's a terrible tragedy. That's another thing that we really need to fix. But I've tried to talk to everybody, Democrats, Republicans, Independents. You know, you don't rack up 53,000 miles without trying to talk to as many people as possible. And we're getting people to listen. We're getting attention on this race for the first time in, well, a very long time. And being able to talk one-on-one or in large groups and being able to answer questions, making myself accessible. I'm campaigning as I will govern as a Secretary of State.
And you mentioned seeing the job in part as an ambassador for things like job creation. How would you envision using the seat as Secretary of State as a bully pulpit or maybe a friendly pulpit to reach out?
Sure. Well, as a Secretary of State, as any elected official, you know, there's certain things that come with that. And being an unofficial ambassador, regardless of what the position is that you're elected to, is one of those duties. You just have to be proactive. The Lieutenant Governor has done a fantastic job of being a jobs ambassador. So I would try to model my Secretary of State term very similar as to how she's doing hers as Lieutenant Governor.
So currently a Republican administration in the state. What if there is a Democratic governor? As a Republican Secretary of State, how do you see yourself reaching out across that partisan line?
In La Crosse County, I was the chairman of the Republican Party long before I got into this race. And I was chairman throughout all of the recalls, and we all remember how divisive that was. La Crosse County leans Democratic. And what I did was, after the recalls were over, I reached out to my counterpart in the La Crosse County Democratic Party, and I said, you know what, we should do something. We should work together. And we came up with a bipartisan Toys for Tots drive. And the whole purpose of that was so that the community could see that even though we disagreed and we differed on political opinion, we agreed that we needed to come together to do what was right for the community. My mom was a staunch Democrat. I got along very well with her. I have no problem working with Democrats, working with Independents, and obviously working with Republicans. That's what's going to be different from me as opposed to my opponent.
Now, say you're elected, you make your outreach to the legislature, and the governor is saying, hey, let's restore these powers, these responsibilities that you mentioned, the corporation issues, the business-related ones, maybe the election ones, and they say, thanks, no. What do you do with this office then, between now and the next election?
Well, that's a bridge we would have to cross. I feel very confident that we're going to be able to find something for this office to do, and that's why I've talked about being an ambassador. Sure, the legislature can say, you know what, we're not going to give anything back, but when you're elected, you're an ambassador for the state, And if you have the ability to be proactive, if you have the leadership skills, which I do, to be proactive, look, I manage a team right now that's multiple times size the staff in the Secretary of State's office. So managing the office will be nothing new for me. I'm a leader. I've been in leadership roles, and we get positive results from what I do. So if the legislature says, no, we're not going to bring these things back, then I'm going to go on my own, and I'm going to do what I can to make sure that I'm earning this paycheck, and that includes being an ambassador. That means contacting, reaching out, dealing with other issues within the state that I can lend my voice to. When you are an elected official, you do have a voice, and it's not your job just to use it for 6 months every 4 years, as my opponent does.
Early voting is going on now, Election Day now under 2 weeks away. Can you leave us with a final message to Wisconsin voters?
Sure. You know, my opponent, Doug LaFollette, has been in this office. He was first elected in 1974. When asked, you know, how are the next 4 years going to be any different from the last 36, he's unable to provide an answer. I have a vision for the next 4 years, and I think that's important. I think the next Secretary of State needs to be somebody that's focused on earning their paycheck, that's focused on doing what's best for the state of Wisconsin, and working to move Wisconsin forward. That's my commitment to each of you, and I would hope that you would consider voting for me, and you can find more information at julianbradley.org.
Julian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Julian Bradley. He's the Republican candidate for Wisconsin's Secretary of State. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our series of forums with the candidates running for Secretary of State. We just heard from Republican candidate Julian Bradley, and a bit later we'll hear from Libertarian Andy Craig and the current Democratic Secretary of State, Doug LaFollette.
Right now we're joined by Jerry Breutzman. He's the Constitution Party candidate for Secretary of State. He joins us now by phone. Jerry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, let's start off with the basic question. Why are you running for Secretary of State?
Yes, I'm running for Secretary of State because over the years, the legislature has stripped away the duties of the office of Secretary of State. However, those particular duties have not gone away. They've simply been reassigned to unelected and unaccountable bureaucrats. Now, contrary to some popular opinion, this has not reduced the size of government. All it's done is transferred those particular duties over to bureaucrats that you can neither see nor hear, and it is invisible to the people of the state of Wisconsin. And I intend to restore the office to its legitimate functions as it was originally intended in the Wisconsin state constitution.
Now, what duties in particular would you like to see brought back to the office of Secretary of State?
The biggest one that I would like to see brought back is overseeing the election process. The election process is currently overseen by the Government Accountability Board. Now, I want to be clear that I know there's a lot of talk on on talk radio regarding the Government Accountability Board or GAB. I don't have anything against the people in that particular office. They've done a fine job, but that's not the issue. The issue is that they're not elected, and they also have their own dedicated funding source, which means that if you don't like what they're doing, that's too bad. You can't do anything about it. Now, it's not an issue right now, but what about in 10 years? What about in 15 years? When you have a whole different group of people in there, what's it going to be like then? I'd like to see the overseeing of the election process brought back under the Secretary of State's office. And again, if you don't like what the Secretary of State is doing, you do have the option to vote that person out and put somebody else in there. So that's a big one.
Yeah,
in particular, I'd like the whole election process to be audited, to make sure that there's fairness throughout for everybody.
Outside of the election process, any other duties you'd like to see either restored to the office of Secretary of State or maybe new ones you'd like to see added?
That's the biggest one right now. There's a lot of other administrative functions. There's a list of them, and I don't have the specifics on that at the moment, but I would like to to see, in particular, the elections brought back under their purview.
Now, to do that, you'd have to get cooperation from the legislature and from the governor's office. I don't think you can just do it by fiat. How would you work together with those bodies to restore those functions to this job?
That's a very good question, and that is where the art of politics comes in. You have to build those relationships with the different legislatures. And let's back up a moment because you brought up an important point. The Secretary of State is an administrative office. It is not a legislative office. And that simply means that the Secretary of State doesn't make laws. They simply administer the functions that are brought to them. Now, getting to your specific point, yeah, you have to build relationships with the legislatures, with the governor's office, with both sides of the aisle, and present a very strong case, a business case, if you will, regarding these particular functions, and let them make the decision. So you'd have to win them over, in a nutshell.
Now, current Secretary of State Doug La Follette has held the office for more than 3 decades. He's running for re-election. What would you bring to the table that he doesn't?
He's actually been in office for 40 years, and 40 consecutive years. During that time, and I think it isn't indicative of just him, but anybody who's been in a particular office for that length of time loses touch with the electorate. And there hasn't been any original ideas brought forward from the Secretary of State's office in my memory. And what I can bring to the office is a lot of private sector and business experience, and experience building those bridges that we just previously discussed, because that's what I do every day. And I'd be able to do that more effectively, I believe, with the experience that I have than the incumbent can do currently.
Now, you're running, representing the Constitution Party. That may be unfamiliar to some Wisconsin voters. Can you give us a sense of what the party stands for?
Yes, I can. The Constitution Party believes that the federal government in particular should be limited to powers that are expressly in the power should be limited to the confines of the Constitution. We take a biblical worldview regarding social issues. That's not a secret. I want to be clear that does not mean that we want to institute some type of national religion or something like that. It just simply is a standard by which we look at social issues, and people can either agree with it or disagree with it, but they'll always know where we stand, which is important. The Constitution Party has been around for about 20 years, and it is a small party, but it is an actual party, so it is recognized by the state of Wisconsin, and that's different than something like the Tea Party, which is simply a movement. The Tea Party is not an actual party. The Constitution Party is.
You're one of two third-party candidates in the race. The other, the Libertarian, we'll be talking to him shortly, is making the case that the position of Secretary of State is outdated, trivial, costing money, and it should be eliminated. Also, the Wisconsin State Journal, their endorsement for this office was eliminate the office. So what do you think? Can you make the case that the office is worth keeping?
You can talk about the offices in every case. The reason you have elected offices is for accountability in government. I mean, ultimately, a dictatorship would be the most efficient. We could have everything simply appointed, but that's not what we want. We want to have offices like Secretary of State, Treasurer, Attorney. We want those to be State Attorney. We want those to be elected so that there's accountability. So if there's something wrong, we can get rid of them. As far as the argument being that they're outdated, well, whose fault is that? That's the fault of the legislature. They stripped away all of those duties. The actual Secretary of State, the person holding that office, has no power to get rid of that office. Let's be clear on that point. Everybody just thinks that, hey, elect me and I will eliminate the office. That's a false statement. They can't. They don't have any power to do so. Only the legislature can, and the legislature hasn't. And they haven't given it any real serious consideration. It's not a real easy process because it's a constitutional office and would have to be, and there's quite a process to remove it. There's been no serious discussion or even actions in that regard. So when I hear statements like it's irrelevant, well, talk to the legislature. You can make it relevant again. It's outdated. Well, it's been there. You could say that about anything. You know, what does that mean? Outdated. Outdated as compared to what? The office is what it is because the people that we elected made it so. And if you want to change that, then you have to have somebody in there who can work with the legislature and get these proper duties put back into place.
And as we wrap up, can you leave us with your final message for our Wisconsin voters?
Yes. I encourage anyone who's listening to really examine the way that you've been voting, your voting patterns. If you're a Democrat, can you really consider yourself to be progressive if you're voting for a guy who's been in there for 40 years? If you're a Republican, I mean, let's face it, the person who's running on the Republican ticket will probably lose. What message are you going to send by voting Republican? I know I'm a minor party with the Constitution Party, but you can send a powerful message by voting for me. Even a small percentage, even 5% of the total vote, can make a big impact in Wisconsin politics. Because remember, many races in Wisconsin are determined by 5% or less. So if a Constitution Party candidate can get in there and guarantee a certain percentage to vote every time, I'm telling you, it'll cause the political establishment to stand up and take note. So I'm encouraging everyone to break the chains of big politics and vote for me, Jerry Breitzman, on November 4th.
Jerry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Jerry Breitzman. He's the Constitution Party candidate for Secretary of State. We also heard from Republican candidate Julian Bradley earlier in the hour.
After the news, we'll talk to two of the other candidates in the race, Libertarian Andy Craig and incumbent Democrat Doug LaFollette. And if you missed any of this week's forums or you want to see our schedule for our upcoming congressional forums, head on over to wisconsinvote.org.